is derived from or corresponds to the biblical word charis, C-H-A-R-I-S. The word charis in pre-biblical or pre-New Testament Greek is the word for love that all the ancient Greek writers used, Thucydides, Sophocles, Plato, Aristotle. It's the one word they used for love, where they meant the love of the gods. It was a love that was absolutely free, in no way coerced. It is a love that is absolutely selfless, and a love that is as generous as only the gods can be. And St. Paul, under divine inspiration, chose that word to use it for grace. In other few Indo-European languages, the word for grace is love, as in the Slav languages. Milost, or its equivalent, is love. The word grace, therefore, for St. Paul means selfless, divine love. Second, when we say that grace is gratuitous, we mean that God confers it freely. He surely gives it both generously and graciously, but the term gratuitous means that God gives it freely in such a way as to be in no way coerced from within and in no way obligated from without. Grace, therefore, is gratuitous because God is not even compelled by his love to give it, nor is he surely obligated by any debt or responsibility to his creatures. Third, the primary type of grace is sanctifying. Fourth, the most fruitful analogy in the Bible for grace is life. As we know, Revelation is filled with terms that are, as we say, analogous, similar to something that we know from nature, and because we know the natural thing, we can somehow understand something of the mystery. There are in Greek three words for life that the New Testament uses. They are bios, psyche, and zoe. This means life, even as we have it in common with the animals. Psyche, which we have in common with the angels. But zoe is life, which in the New Testament, again, under divine inspiration, the sacred writers, especially St. John, regularly and consistently uses zoe in the Greek to refer to God's life. It is the kind of life that Father, Son, and Holy Spirit share among themselves. And it is this life that those who are in the state of grace receive from God. Fifth, the most regularly used term in the Bible for grace as vital principle of a soul's union with God is, as we've just said, zoe. Number six, the essence of life is self-activity. And a thing is that much more alive as the activity is more sublime and the independence of anyone else is more complete. That's why God is simply life, because his activity is infinite and he in no way depends on anyone for what he has. Seventh, the supernatural life in each one of us has a beginning. It is not true that it has no beginning, because we receive the supernatural life when we are baptized. But the supernatural life, even as our natural physical life, both have a beginning, but both can also have an end. Just as we can lose our physical life, so we can lose our supernatural life. And just as there are degrees and intensities, so to speak, in the physical life, so we can be more or less alive supernaturally. 8. Struggle in the supernatural life is necessary. It is surely unavoidable. And the least we can say is that it's useful. What wisdom to know that it is necessary. 9. Conflict in the supernatural life arises from the world, the flesh, and the devil. Out of 36 who took the quiz, only 3 missed it. Congratulations. So it's not just the world or the world in the flesh. It is also the evil spirit that is the source of conflict in the supernatural life. 10. What ultimately determines the degree and vitality of our spiritual life is, my dear friends, 36 took the quiz. 33 thought it was something else than the providence of God. Now, notice, I put the adverb ultimately, mainly, finally determines not only how much we've got, but even whether we've got spiritual life is the providence of God. Now, it surely also depends on our cooperation with God's grace, and no doubt the difference among people. It is mainly the providence of God. Sometime, Sister Imelda, if it's agreeable with you, we might give a course on the providence of God. It would be a delightful course that I would love to teach. 11. There is growth in a supernatural life because of merit. Now, surely it's goodwill. It is not unknown features or factors. But notice, what is merit? Merit is the reward we obtain from God for cooperating with divine grace. There are 3 parts, therefore, to merit. You must have received grace, otherwise you've got nothing to cooperate with. Secondly, you must cooperate. And third, it is God's reward for having cooperated. It is His appreciation for our cooperating with His will. 12. Mortal sin is compared with venial sin as death is compared with sickness. 13. The divine indwelling means that God is present in a special way in some souls. Which souls? In those in the state of grace. Or, as I think we covered this last time, was it? The relationship between the divine indwelling and sanctifying grace. The divine indwelling is the cause. Sanctifying grace is the effect. God's presence means that He affects or influences, well, the creature to which He is present. The best theological definition of nothing is where God is absent, which is the definition of what existed before God made the world. Nothing. The moment God made the world, He began to be present. His presence means the exercise of His divine power. And, of course, even as we, don't you think so? We can be more present to some people than to others. Would you agree? And if we don't know, they sure do. The degree of influence, what we give or do for a person, measures the degree of our presence. So God, is he present in this chalk? If the chalk would say yes, it would say, now that you ask me, yes. Is he present in an animal, in a puppy? The puppies of the wealthy, well-dressed matrons guide along Park Avenue. I have to say this. Two very refined ladies met on the corner of Park and 85th. One of the two had a little tiny, less than a Pekingese. Is it something smaller than a Pekingese? Whatever it is, she had it. It wasn't more than 5 inches off the ground. Her friend looked down and saw this creature on a leash, and she leaned over and talked baby talk. Well, if I had a candid camera, can you imagine? Pardon me. So God is present in an animal. He is present to a human being who is not in the state of grace. But he is extraordinarily present in one who is in the state of grace. Why? Because of the effect which he produces. And the effect that he produces in one in whom he dwells, as we say, is sanctifying grace. Number 14. The indwelling consists in God's presence as the object of special knowledge by the mind and special love by the will. Those in whom God dwells by grace can know him and love God as no one else. 15. The love that comes from the indwelling spirit is experiential. It's not experimental, as though we have to try it out, see whether we want some. It's experiential. You know it. Now the degree and the measure, and if you wish, the intensity of the experience, is also part of God's grace. A good theological definition of mysticism is the constant experience of God's presence. So the constancy is what denominates mysticism. Most of us, I think I'm saying this, non-mystical human beings, don't have the experience constantly. Then, as we know, among the mystics, there are degrees and degrees of intensity. Even to the point of being aware of nothing else, which is a good definition of ecstasy, where you experience nothing else except the presence of God. 16. The indwelling confers the virtue of faith, which is a gift and gives light. But the only reason it's a gift and confers light is because it is a virtue. Some gifts come and go. Virtues stay. That's a good definition of a virtue. It is a good habit that stays. 17. According to St. Augustine, whoever possesses God is, now, surely wealthy and admittedly wise. At least Augustine says, happy. And I would add, if you are wise, you should be happy. And if you're wealthy, especially in things of the Spirit, you should also be happy. 18. The precise difference between actual and sanctifying grace is that actual grace is transitory. Of course, it's not active. That's why we call it sanctifying grace. And what else would it be except supernatural? What makes it distinctive is that it is, unlike sanctifying grace, actual grace comes and goes. It's transitory. 19. The virtue of faith is, surely it's a good habit. It's not acquired. It must be infused. And 20. The virtue of faith can grow and diminish. 6. Must have had a doubt out of 36 whether the virtue of faith can diminish. Oh, yes, it can. In fact, that's what a weakening of sanctifying grace means. It's not just a cliche or a phrase. Sanctifying grace equals faith, hope, and charity. The more intense the life of God in me, the stronger my faith and hope and love. And the weaker this state of grace, the weaker the corresponding faith, hope, and charity. And consequently, every time we sin, we weaken sanctifying grace, which means we weaken our faith, hope, and charity. Our faith is less intelligible. The mysteries of faith make less sense. We went over this, didn't we? The qualities of faith, didn't we? Well, there are 3 qualities, just for the record. This is faith. Faith can either increase or decrease on 3 levels. On the level of intelligibility, I can either see more or less of what I believe. Some people's faith is so weak, they hardly see any sense in what they believe. They still somehow hold on. The deeper and stronger my faith, the more intelligently I believe. The more I see, the more I understand. And I don't have to have a PhD, which, by the way, can be a liability. Secondly, the stronger my faith, the more certainly I believe. A strong faith is a firm faith. And thirdly, the stronger my faith, the more clear it is. The more clearly I distinguish among the things I believe and between what I believe and what somebody else tells me. Our faith should be intelligible, certain, and clear. And depending on the degree of our sanctifying grace, our faith is correspondingly understandable. We have a grasp of it, certain, we are sure of it, and clear, we know what we believe and what we don't have to believe. And among the things we believe, we see clearly. Any questions before we go on? Now, what I've done for the present lecture, what I will try to do is finish commenting on Redemptor Hominis of Pope John Paul, now during the first period, then after the break, and before lunch. Depending on how fast we go, and it's pretty much, I suppose, my setting my own pace, if we don't finish, if you don't mind, we'll take some time from the next section on the spiritual life. I think the encyclical is so basic. I have now lectured, I think, for 9 hours in 3 different academic situations on the encyclical. And the more often I lecture, the more I see in it. All I know is there's much more than meets the eye. First, its theme. His theme can be expressed in a sentence. Jesus Christ is the center and goal of the universe and of human history. In order to appreciate the full import of what the Pope is saying, we have to go to the letters of St. Paul, notably his letters to the Colossians, his letter to the Ephesians, and his two letters to the Corinthians. And among these four that I've mentioned, especially Colossians, what is the Pope saying, which is thematic and runs through what was 100 pages in text in the copy that I received from Cardinal Kroll, an advanced copy of the encyclical, was 100 pages of original larger type translation than you have in your, say, published text. He first of all is saying that Christ is the center of both the universe and of human history. He's really making four statements. Christ is center, Christ is goal, and Christ is center and goal of both the universe and of human history. What does he mean by saying that Christ is the center? The center of anything is that around which, well, everything else revolves. Christ alone gives meaning to the universe. Christ alone gives meaning to man's history. Now, if this were a class in Christology, we could spend more time, and every one of the sentences that I will analyze on the board deserves a couple of hours lecture, at least in a few words. Christ, therefore, is the center because he gives the principal meaning, not just to human history, but to the created universe. Now, the difference between universe and history is that the universe, well, is the whole of what exists, but conceived apart from the entrance and the constant re-entrance of the divine and human will. What makes history history? Well, history we commonly define as the record of past human events. But we who have the faith know that those human events are shaped by two kinds of will. The divine will, which is constantly entering, keeps entering human life. And the human will, which in varying degrees cooperates or fails to cooperate with the divine will. The universe is the status quo of the world. It's the sun, moon, and stars. It's all that we know of the universe or of the world apart from God's will entering and altering as he does. God's will does not, for example, enter the solar system. The sun does not cooperate with God's will because it's got no will to cooperate with the divine will. Yet Christ is center on both levels. Christ is center and is the main reason for the world. God made all the rest of the world in order that, having become man, Christ would be the peak and the acme of the universe. As the ancient fathers say, and our Holy Father is very well versed in the ancient fathers, that God, as it were, made various orders of being from the lowest material, inanimate creature on upwards to the highest. But he was not finished until God became man. And as far as language will allow us to say it, and it demands, the Creator became a creature. All the rest makes sense in the universe only because God became man. And in terms of human history, again, as so many of the fathers teach, and among the, this is good to hear, this is St. Francis' position, by the way. There are no Franciscan theologians that I know of. In fact, they probably would be expelled from the order if they taught otherwise. That God would have become man even though man had not sinned. Why? As an expression of his love. Now, de facto, man did sin. And Christ, therefore, is the center of fallen human history. Well, that's not what the Pope is saying. In other words, he bought St. Francis and the Franciscan position that Christ is the highest manifestation of God's love for man. It is not only in order to redeem man, but to show how much he loves man. Because what we love, we want to be united with. Or in more prosaic language, what we love, we embrace. The incarnation was God's embracing the human race. And the embrace, we believe, will remain for eternity. Having become man, he will never cease to be a human being. He is also the goal in a mysterious way that we cannot begin to penetrate. Everything in the world was made in order to somehow reach Christ, to fulfill the purpose that Christ has, namely, to make us happy. So that, and here I should like to start with number one, otherwise I'll be cutting into what I've already got down below, and I don't want to steal my own thunder, such as it is. The encyclical theologically begins with section 7. The first 6 sections are useful, very personal. He is embarrassed that he is elected Pope. He just cannot understand. It's beyond his comprehension. But, he says, but I am Pope. But for the first 6 sections, you can tell he's embarrassed. It's his first encyclical. He's never written one before. He's winding up. By section 7, he settles down to his message. I understand he wrote the encyclical in Polish. So he could just put his heart into it. And then he had it translated into Latin, and all existing translations are from the Latin. I can't imagine what the translation would have been if it had come from the Polish, because there are not too many people that can, as you know. Not enough people even know Latin. In any case, the official text is the Latin. I should add, by the way, the translation is good. It's literal, but it's not always literary. Sometimes the language is so Latin that you wish they'd used another term, but maybe the order got out. Stick to the Latin. Don't improvise. No paraphrases. In any case, number 7 is the first section where the theology of the encyclical begins. And it ties in with what we've just been saying. Christ is our destiny. Let me read, and might be well to see where I have chosen. And I have about 25 passages that I have chosen that I think synthesize the thesis. Generally one sentence, sometimes a little more. It occurs in the second paragraph of the 7th section. And the text reads, our spirit, he is set in one direction, the only direction for our intellect, will, and heart is. towards Christ, our Redeemer, towards Christ, the Redeemer of man. What does it mean to say that Christ is our destiny? Evidently, it is towards Christ we are going. It is to possess Christ that we were made. This bears, I think, more clarification than we commonly might give it. For example, the opening words of the Spiritual Exercises of St. Ignatius read, "Man was created to praise, reverence, and serve God, his Creator, and by this means to save his soul." So you might say, well, our destiny is to save our soul. Correct. Or to reach heaven. Correct. To attain the beatific vision. Correct. But inadequate. Because God having become man, he is not only, as he told us in John's Gospel, the way. That's what he is here. He is also the life. We are then to possess the God-man and not just God. What significance is there in that? Well, that the God we're going to possess in heaven is a human being. And we, being human beings, will possess God as human beings. After the last day, we shall, please God, be reunited, body and soul. It will be not only our intellects beholding the face of God. It will also be our bodies seeing Christ, talking with him. We shall hear him with our bodily ears. I'm not sure what the mark of friendship or sign of friendship will be in heaven. For the life of me, I can't imagine shaking hands with our Lord. But you get the general drift. Our destiny is the God-man. Second, Christ speaks to all mankind. This occurs in the fourth paragraph of the seventh section, and it reads, there are a couple of sentences. The church does not cease to listen to his words. She rereads them continually. With the greatest devotion, she reconstructs every detail of his life. These words are listened to also by non-Christians. In other words, Christ, who is God become man, after 2,000 years, has been heard not only by those who believe in his name. This is the first time I've seen it in a papal document. And my job, because it's teaching theology, I've read, I'm sure, thousands by now of pages of the church's documentation. I've never seen explicitly stated that Christ is listened to also by those who are not Christians. Notice, it is not merely that Christ speaks to them, but that they listen. The difference between listening and hearing, when you listen, you want to hear. It's the will that makes the difference. You can hear with your ears. You listen with your heart. The Pope is telling us that by now the whole human race has been listening to Christ and is different because of it. And as one who has spent the last 15 years teaching the non-Christian religions, You cannot imagine how happy I was to see it. Thanks, Holy Father. I've been telling this to my students. In any case, even people that are called technically non-Christians are not really non-Christian. If you want to distinguish between a noun and an adjective, they are non-Christian as a noun because they don't profess the fullness of the Christian faith. But they are not non-Christian because they have been profoundly affected. To illustrate, when I teach, as I have over the years, Hinduism, notably the most important and popular sacred writing of the Hindus, the Bhagavad Gita, usually abbreviated Gita, G-I-T-A, I tell my students that about four chapters of about approximately 24, which are really books, in that sacred writing, have entered Hinduism from Christianity. You read the passages. If I thought of bringing a copy of the Gita with me, I would have read it. And if I hadn't told you it was Hinduism, you would be sure it was the Gospel of John. As a matter of fact, it is the Gospel of John. So when I teach, or have been teaching, my Jesuit scholastics here in Chicago from India to go back to teach in our schools in India, I will tell them, now, you know the Jesuit technique. You tell your students, now this is Hinduism. You see, we are forbidden to teach Christianity. Fine, no trouble. We'll teach the Hindu scriptures. Give an lick and a promise to the other parts of the Gita, but concentrate on these chapters that scholars have shown, and the text proves it, have been incorporated from early 1st and 2nd century Christian sources. Isn't that beautiful? Or in Hinayana Buddhism, and I could talk, these are tempting insights the Pope gives. Honest. Christ not only speaks to, but has been heard by and is listened to, the great Mahatma Gandhi. There were two writings that he always carried with him wherever he went. He died as a Hindu with the New Testament and the Imitation of Christ. Both, I'm happy to relate, given to him. I hope they didn't charge him by our Jesuit fathers. It may be my only chance to say it, so I'll say it. 3 years ago, one of my students, a practicing lawyer in Manhattan, called me up beforehand. He said, do you mind if I bring my secretary to your residence sometime in mid-afternoon? So he brought Lillian to meet me. She had never met a priest before. My lawyer student was at an all-Jewish law office. There wasn't a single Christian except he, all Jews, the lawyers and the personnel. Lillian was a Jewess, but she had typed a term paper that he wrote for my class. This started her thinking. She began to ask questions. Finally, he told her, you've got to talk to my teacher. So he told his partners, I've got important business in Upper Manhattan. I need my secretary. It was important business, and he sure needed his secretary. Listen to this. During her lunch period, near Penn Station in Lower Manhattan, Lillian said she didn't eat a big lunch. She had an hour for lunch. She would go into the church, the Capuchin Church, Penn Station, and sit in the back. By that time, she was told that Christ was present, that the Messiah was on earth, she was told. and she'd go there and pray regularly. She told this to one of her Catholic girlfriends. Couldn't have been much of a Catholic, because she told her, "Lillian, do you really believe he's there? Don't you know that's just symbolism?" Listen to this. The Jewish girl said, "Don't tell me that's symbolism. I know he's there." Needless to say, she became a Catholic. Christ speaks to all mankind. But notice, the Pope is setting up this theme. You know why? So we might talk Christ. That's why when I'm out riding, and I don't ask the chauffeur his religion, I make a big ostentatious sign of the cross. And he recites the Hail Mary. Christ speaks to all mankind. But he will be speaking only if we proclaim him, right? He needs our lips to talk. The church's role is within the ministry of Christ. It occurs at the very end, the last sentence of section 7. I quote, "The church stays within the sphere of the mystery of the redemption, which has become the fundamental principle of her life and mission." Oh, that's what the Pope says should be the church's mission. Unfortunately, there are a lot of people who have different ideas. That's why he went to Latin America, to remind everybody from the bishops down, the church's business is the business that Christ said was his business. Remember when Mary and Joseph finally found him after 3 days in the temple? "I must be about my Father's business," one translation. And therefore, and the Pope is here speaking especially to bishops, priests, and religious, the church's role is within the ministry of Christ. There's enough there to talk about. And the world needs Christ. In God's name, he's saying, don't talk other things. There isn't enough time. Life is too short. Talk about Christ and the world's need of him, and the world which desperately wants someone to tell the truth and not be afraid. Tell people how to reach their destiny. They will listen. Number 4. I am handicapped. Christ reveals what is true humanity. Is that it? Okay. What true humanity is. That occurs in number 8, and it's in about the middle of the second long paragraph. And the Pope made sure that he italicized. He must have put lines that he wants in italics. It reads, "Christ the new Adam, in the very revelation of the mystery of the Father and of his love, fully reveals man to himself and brings to light his most high calling." What's the Pope saying? Christ revealed many things. And in fact, all that we know about Christianity finally somehow stems from him. But there is one thing, and remember, the Pope is still, you might say, laying the foundation stones. That the whole encyclical is a foundation for what I'm sure will follow later on. But the earlier parts are more fundamental than, say, the later parts of the encyclical. Since he wants to appeal to the whole human race, believers and non-believers. In fact, not just unbelievers, but anti-believers. His focus is on man, because millions don't believe in God, but no one, except those who are mentally deranged, don't believe in man. You follow the logic? It's the logic of Thomas Aquinas when he was arguing with the Muslims in the 13th century.